Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. Today, I'm joined by Beth H. Piatote. She's Assistant Professor of Native American Studies and Ethnic Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's just published a phenomenal new book called Domestic Subjects, Gender, Citizenship, and Law in Native American Literature from Yale University Press. I really enjoyed this discussion, not only because Beth's introduced me to a host of Native authors from an era of aggressive assimilation, people like Pauline Johnson, Alice Callahan, John Oskison, but also for her deeply incisive analysis about what made these figures particularly dynamic and courageous. I hope you enjoy it as well. Beth Piatote, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you, Andrew. It's really a pleasure.
Yeah, no problem. So congratulations, not only for this really eloquent and provocative new book, but also for being the first to publish with Yale University Press's Henry Rowe Cloud series on American Indians and Modernity. Your book is called Domestic Subjects, Gender, Citizenship, and Law in Native American Literature. And if it's any indication of what we can expect from the Henry Rowe Cloud series, they're very exciting things to come. And before we dive into your book, I want to start by asking you to introduce yourself and talk a bit about your path to this project.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. I do want to start by acknowledging Yale University Press, and particularly the visionary efforts of Professor Ned Blackhawk and the head of the press, Christopher Rogers, in establishing this new series. So you asked how I came to this project. Well, part of it is a personal background. From my mother's side, I'm Nez Perce. I'm enrolled in the Confederated Tribes of the Colville Reservation in eastern Washington. I grew up in Idaho, and my dad's family is actually German Mennonite background. So I grew up on a farm in Idaho, and then I ended up going to a Mennonite college in Kansas. And I was a history major in college, and I think throughout my life I've always been really interested in history and the material conditions under which people are able to express themselves, and the limits on what people can say and do in any given historical moment. And, you know, part of my attention to the material world then played out in my first job after I did my undergraduate, in that I worked as a journalist for a number of years through my 20s. And what I found is, as a reporter, that I would frequently start reading the metaphorical back into the material. And of course, we do the opposite or the inverse in reading literature, is reading the metaphorical out to the material. But I think it's just the way that I see the world is, whichever direction I'm reading it, I can't read those things separately. And I, in fact, remember the day I decided to go to graduate school I was reading the newspaper, and there was an article then. At that time, the Sally Hemings story had just come out about Thomas Jefferson and this other family he had. And there was this story about Hemings's descendants not being able to go into the cemetery. And I remember reading that and going, oh, that's so symbolic, you know. And then I put down the paper and thought, I think I know I need to go to graduate school. So there were these other observations I was having about the interplay between literary or cultural practices and the material world. And one was, as a Native American, part of my cultural experience just growing up and being around Native people is the ways that people would always be making jokes about federal Indian law. And I think I just started noticing over time the power of people getting together and joking about the force of Indian law. And when I started graduate school, I was really thinking, if we're doing it now, these earlier writers who have been a little bit neglected in American Indian literary studies and in American literary studies, that these writers were also talking about the law and turning it over in various ways, not only joking about it, but also using its aesthetics and changing its forms. And really that, because everyday life in Native America is so shaped by law, it's only natural that cultural forms and literature would also be shaped and illuminating and pushing back against law. So those were the things I was thinking going into graduate school. And I ended up, you know, writing a dissertation and then very substantially revising that into this book, Domestic Subjects.
It's not surprising at all that having read the book that you have a sort of lifelong interest in history. It's gender, citizenship, and law. These are themes that historians are ceaselessly wrestling with. I guess I'm wondering why you chose literature as a way to explore these, or was literature the first move through which you found history, if that makes sense? I guess I'm wondering why you chose to pursue literature as a graduate career as opposed to, say, history.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I do think of my book as literary history. So part of that is that there's something interesting, I think, that happens in the intersection between literature and law, in that they make each other recognizable in a certain way when you look at them together. I was trying to explain this to some students the other day. There's a piece by Luther Standingbear in which he writes very lovingly about his father, and this takes place in this same period, the assimilation period, mm-hmm. in which a lot of government policies were trying to break children away from their attachment to their families and to physically remove them from their families and to sort of push them to attach themselves to the United States. Like, that was the strategy of assimilation. And so Luther Standingbear writes this beautiful piece about how much he loves his father. So why is that such a politically revolutionary thing to do? Why is it so resistant politically? He was only saying that he loved his father. So if you only read the piece, it's just without thinking about the law and the history as its context, it's only a piece about a young man who loved his father despite being taken away to boarding school. But the point at which you can understand the deep politics of what he's doing is when you see it as a statement of the failure of the assimilation policy and as a repudiation of the violence of that policy. It wasn't only, I mean, maybe it is that love is so incredibly powerful, but you can't see its power or understand the dimensions of it without understanding how the federal policies were trying to break that bond apart. Mm. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think similarly, or maybe inversely, if you write a book that's just about federal Indian law, like mm-hmm. you know, case by case example, exploration of legislative acts, you also don't get the full story that you would if you also talk about, you know, a son who loves his father. We don't necessarily see that in a pure legal history.
Right. Yeah, because these, if you only look at the laws and the policies, and this is particularly where domesticity and sentimentality can obscure violence, is around these things like, well, we're going to provide education. Well, that seems nurturing and elevating. I think
who's against education, you know?
Right, exactly. It's hard to be against these things that are domestic or about domestic subjects. And, you know, the other part of literature that is so compelling to me is that it also produces the alternative imaginary and also shows how the imaginative lives of Native people during this very difficult period were also a site, was also a site itself of this battle. Because the policies wanted Indian people to conceptualize themselves as citizens of the United States and as belonging to a different national body than they were born into. So if we think about Indian nations as being their own sort of national bodies in which these Indian children and families are born into, trying to shift that affiliation meant you have to imagine, you have to conceptualize, and then you have to physically remake yourself in a way that fits this other national identity, and that imaginary was a battleground in itself. And so for these writers to produce these alternative imaginaries, to make different, to take the storyline and change the ending, to do things like create states of suspension rather than foreclosure, all of those were parts of winning that space of the imaginary, and I think really helped people survive. Because going into this project, one of my main questions was, how did people survive this violence? I mean, I have children. It's almost unbearable to think of them being taken away, or entire communities that all their children were taken away. And for all of those children to have only each other to turn to in their loneliness and alienation in the boarding schools, it's just incredible strength that these people had. And to be able to show both the violence of these policies, but also how people survived. That I think was a really important goal for me in this book. And literature was a space where we could think about the affective costs and also these points of resilience and the functioning of the imaginary in working through these legal and material conditions that people were in.
So this period that you grapple with here in American Indian history, between 1879, 1934, and those mm-hmm. dates are important for different reasons. But this is a period that I think for a long time beguiled historians. I don't know if that's also true in English and literature, but I was looking back through Phil DeLoria's Indians in Unexpected Places. Mm-hmm. And he says Indian people living between 1890 and 1934 often simply vanish from the master narrative. He said this mm-hmm. after looking at sort of standard history textbooks and even some, you know, monographs from the profession. I think the past 10 years, scholars have worked on rectifying this. I think I've actually very happy to have featured some of those people on this program, albeit mostly they were historians. But I'm wondering what attracted you to this period particularly?
Yeah, well, I think that it was exactly this moment of domestication. So I think this reason that you're identifying from Phil's wonderful book, it has to do with this sense of 1890 and the end of the Indian Wars with the massacre at Wounded Knee. And like, okay, that's done. And it just in the 1890s, there was this huge wave of national domestication. And I think that's at the point where things get quiet, and get quiet in terms of like a military history. And I think what I wanted to do is show that these domestic policies, which were administrative, which were things like taking children to school and dividing up Indian lands through allotment, they were administrative policies, but they relied upon that military conquest, and they relied upon a history of violence, and they enacted other forms of violence in themselves. And so I think that that there was this sense of military conquest, and that the Indian Wars were over. And what I'm trying to assert in the book, and what other scholars have also asserted, is like the Indian Wars are not over, and they certainly, I would say, intensified on a different front during this period. And so we can think, well, why? I think that the domestication of Native peoples fell into this larger domestication, national domestication project. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason, perhaps, that it isn't so sharply focused in a lot of historical work, although there is a lot of great work during this time. So I don't want to at all obscure that.
You have this really, this quote, if I may, this really wonderfully written book, by the way, but the cavalryman was supplanted, or rather supplemented, by the field matron, the Hotchkiss by the transit, and the prison by the school. A turn to the domestic front, even As the last shots at Wounded Knee echoed in America's collective ear, mark not the end of conquest, but rather its renewal. It's really challenging, that sharp periodization that would put an end marker and say, this is the end of the violence of colonialism. It's not at all the case, as you very convincingly put it. I want to talk about also, you open the book, actually you open every chapter with a photograph.
Yeah.
And as you note, actually, at the outset, this is a very fraught moment for Native people and photographic documentation. Mm-hmm. Maybe it still is in a lot of ways, but these were mechanisms of surveillance or exhibition, and very complicated. And, you know, Phil DeLoria talks a lot about photography in his book as well. Why did you decide to include these photographs? And maybe you can speak about, you know, one or two of them. For instance, you open the book with this image of school children playing with dolls. Can you talk a bit about the photography you chose to include?
Yeah. Well, that opening image, when I found it, I was so excited because the photograph is three Nez Perce girls, and they are wearing school uniforms and these handmade lace collars. So they're probably at a government school, although it's on their reservation. And they're sitting on the grass, and one of them is putting a baby doll into a cradle board that has this beautiful floral beadwork on it. And, you know, one of them is sort of making a teepee, and another one is sort of peeking into her teepee at her little doll in its bed. And it's such a beautiful idea, and I loved it because the photograph was taken by the assistant to the allotment agent. So the photograph was taken by Jane Gay, who accompanied Alice Fletcher, who allotted the Nez Perce Reservation. And the photograph was produced as part of the allotment process itself. And that was very compelling to me. And also what was compelling to me is just how deeply engaged these girls are in their play. And I saw as they were playing house, basically, and imagining their own babies and their own families and their own communities, that they were imagining an Indian future that had these structures, these traditional structures, both literally and sort of culturally, spiritually. And I wanted to argue, and I argued this a little bit in the introduction, that these girls playing with the dolls, it's not just representative of the struggle of that time over children and land and homes and futures, but that it is itself the struggle. And to bring the material and metaphorical, they are the same in that photograph. And that's one of the arguments of the book, that these struggles were the same and working out in these really complex ways. So I found that photograph and I thought, oh, I want to put this on the cover, but then I'd heard these stories about, like, sometimes the press doesn't let you use the picture that you... So I put it inside, you know, I put it in the introduction so that the photograph would be there. Of course, Yale was wonderful. They let me do everything that I wanted to do. But that's what got me started on the photographs. And I ended up, I think it's very typical with literary books that if you have photographs in it, there are photographs of the authors. Mm. And in my book, there's only one photograph of one author, and it's Mourning Dove that illustrates chapter 3. And it's a staged photograph that was part of one of her publicity photographs. And so I read that image a little bit and talking about her labor as a writer these moments of the sort of uncertainty of the photograph itself.
Yeah, it's quite a photograph.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
I think all of the photographs are beautiful in different ways, and also they all have they all have different moods attached to them. So, let's see. Did you want to ask about another photograph, or with the interplay of the photos?
I mean, I was more curious about why you chose to include the ones you did, but I think I have a sense of that. I wanted to actually, I want to introduce a couple of the authors, actually, that you talk about. But actually, first, I'm hoping to introduce a couple of the terms that you that you bring into this book. You've opted for a term, tribal, national, domestic. How does that differ from simply speaking of the tribe or the nation?
Yeah. Well, so I was trying to find a space in between those two terms. I tend to be very comfortable saying tribe. Mm-hmm. But I also think we're talking about national formations and the way in which settler national formations sort of force a certain type of political identity upon native polities that aren't necessarily natural to them. And I wanted to make visible that the tribal, national, domestic is a distinct space that has its own geography and its own boundaries and its own sort of conceptual identity, that it is a domestic space within this larger national domestic space in which these two types of national domesticities are overlapping and in competition with each other. And so I try to think about that so that we can think from inside of the tribal national domestic and say, okay, this is the national domestic space for Native people. And the U.S. national domestic is the foreign domestic to us.
Right.
And that's sort of the perspective that I was trying to create by talking specifically about a tribal national domestic. And I hyphenate tribal national domestic, the tribal national part, because I don't want to just take the national as a given or as a natural formation. And I think it's easy to do when you're trying to assert sovereignty or trying to articulate a set of political rights. But those political rights are only possible because of nationalism, which I think, you know, it's perfectly normal to critique nationalism as a form. And so I think I'm trying to include some space for critique of nationalism or the national as a form within having a space to assert some rights from the perspective of a tribal national. Mm. So that's how terminology is tricky. I'm going to say I don't think that it's the most elegant solution to that problem, but that's part of the political niche we're in, is that there aren't easy terms or easy ways out. Things are kind of be awkward.
It reminds me of another point you make, at least when you're talking about the multiple sovereignties or multiple sort of polities. You make a point that you know, there's been this sort of transnational turn, but that Native American studies already is inherently a transnational project. I thought that was an interesting point. You also sort of participate. There are sort of broader trends in Native American literary studies that you're both in conversation with, but also, you know, shaping in your own way, like American Indian literary nationalism, for instance. But maybe we can talk about a couple of the authors now. I was going to, and as a way to maybe get at this idea of entangled consent or entwined consent. It's particularly drawn out in the first chapter of Writings, where you look at Pauline Johnson, E. Pauline Johnson, and John M. Oskison. Am I right there? I know I asked you in the pre-interview. Oskison. Oskison. Can you introduce us to these writers? Maybe talk a bit about what drew you to their work, but then talk a bit about entangled consent, entwined consent. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So when I discovered Pauline Johnson, it was so wonderful. I love teaching her in my classes. She was She was born in Brantford, Ontario, and her father was a Mohawk leader, and her mother was British, from the Howells family. She's actually distantly related to William Dean Howells, the writer. And she grew up, she became a writer, and she wrote this wonderful story called she was a very prolific writer, and she wrote in many genres. And one of the reasons I'm really attracted to the writers of this period is because they all wrote in multiple genres. They wrote fiction, nonfiction, journalism, short stories, novels. You know, they did everything. It's wonderful. And they were very politically active in different ways. They gave speeches. They didn't confine themselves. All writing counted. And so she wrote very prolifically throughout her life. And she wrote plays and performed plays. And so, you know, a number of years ago, I came across a collection of her short stories, and I was really drawn to this story, A Red Girl's Reasoning. And, you know, it's about an interracial marriage between an Indian woman and a Canadian man, a white man. And he sort of meets her on the reserve, and they fall in love, they get married, they go to the city. One night at a ball, some people are asking her about her family, and her father had been a trader, so he was white, settler, and her mother was Native. And so they said, oh, did your parents get married by the priest? And she said, no. And they said, oh, well, then did they get married by the magistrate? And she said, no, they were married by Indian rights. And this moment at this ball creates this incredible scandal, because the story came out in 1892, and it was incredibly popular in Canada when it came out in Dominion Magazine. It won an award, in fact. And anyway, back to the moment at the ball. There's this big scandal, Charlie, the husband, gets very upset, and he leaves, and he sends her home. Later that night, they have a big argument. And in their argument, they are talking about rights, R-I-T-E-S, about marriage rights. But it actually very quickly morphs into and overlaps with a conversation about political rights. And eventually, she says, you know, if you know, you're saying that my parents were never married because they got married by Indian rights. And she said, but I was married to you in a church, and you are not married to me in Indian rights. So if their marriage doesn't count, then our marriage doesn't either. And she takes her ring off and throws it across the room and says, that ring is as empty to me as Indian rights are to you. Mm. And this whole time they're talking about rights, but of course, where do those rights come from? It's from the state, from the establishment of, like, what counts as political rights. What does marriage mean? What kinds of attachments and property rights do you have out of that? So, to quickly summarize this story, he leaves because he's angry, and he goes to walk off his anger. When he comes back, she's gone. She's left him during the night. And he follows her for a long time. He tries to find her. He eventually finds her in this other town. He throws himself down before her, says, you know, I didn't understand. I'm sorry. Please take me back. And she says, no. Mm-hmm. And it's such a wonderful story. And in the very end of the story, he goes back to his hotel room. He's totally distraught. He throws himself on his bed and says, God, you know, why have you forsaken me? I feel, you know, I don't even have you tonight. And the very end of this story is his dog licking his sleeve. It's so, so sad. Okay, so this is, I mean, to me, this is an amazing story to happen in, like, 1892, or just really any time. You know?
It is, and you say it found a wide audience among non-Native Canadians. Wow.
Right. Well, you know, and I think part of that had to do with Canada's relationship to England, and a sense of standing of like Canadian. I mean, that's what some people have sort of made of that story, but it's also just a wonderful story of sort of the plucky heroine rejecting. And so she this works on multiple scales because it rejects what's happening in the genre of sentimental fiction, where, you know, the, there's a happy resolution, right? That's domestic, and the plucky heroine comes through and ends up happy. But in this story, both figures end up heartbroken for different reasons. And the reason why this story becomes very interesting when you look at the law is because it does show the ways that law racializes different subjects. And what it also shows is the way that the law can name specific subjects, but all state subjects are within its grasp. So Charlie, who should be the most secure subject under the Canadian legal system, the white man, he's the one who is destroyed, essentially, by the Indian Act. So the Indian Act only names the effects upon Indians. But by putting the law and the literature together, you can see that the law is stratified in ways that even the unnamed subjects can come under its force and under its damage. So in the end, both figures suffer losses, and they suffer these losses unequally. But Charlie's not outside of the Indian Act, as if you read the law by itself, you would see that it was. Okay, so I found the story, and I realized there were all these amazing dimensions in the story, and I would just want everybody to read her stories. And that, you know, one of the things I wanted to bring out about these writers is that they worked in conventions, but to make these political arguments, they had to bend the conventions of the genre. And that's where law actually has an effect on aesthetics. So, you know, the limits of law also turn into the limits of aesthetics. So if I could just use one other example from the book, this comes out more powerfully in the discussion of in the second chapter on adoption.
Right.
And this, again, is looking at a short story by Pauline Johnson along with a sentimental novel by Alice Callahan.
Right.
Yes, Wainema. And so there are two sort of contexts thinking about this book. And one of them is that at this time, Indian women and all Indian adults are wards. They don't have full personhood under the state. And so even as a mother, you're still a ward. And during this time, there's a lot of activism by white women who also do not have full citizenship rights, but find their place in the public sphere by advocating for the rights of working class women or African Americans or Native Americans. And so these sort of, I come up with this idea of tiered maternalism to sort of reflect the relationship between white women who found a place in the public sphere by becoming the, quote, mothers to Indian mothers, because there's this logical impossibility of wardship and maternity. So that's one context. And then the other context is that this was a time in which sentimental motherhood, which was so dominant in literary works, in mainstream literary works, that was an impossibility in thinking about Native women, because Native women were either sort of in policy and in sort of popular culture conceptualized as drudges or as very promiscuous, as having a sexuality that needed to be contained. And, you know, one of the dominant laws at that time of this period was the removal of Indian children from their families. And this legal and social construct of Indian women as incompetent. And so there's this whole scale of impossibility around the idea of a competent, loving, maternal Indian woman. And so one of the things that literature is able to do is to make a thinkable subject. So if the subject can exist in literature, then it can exist in the culture, and then it can exist in law. And basically, the sentimental mother that was Indian, who was Indian, was not conceivable under the law or under the culture at that time. And these writers helped make it happen. And the way that they helped make it happen is by coming up with a solution to this problem that Indian women were seen as incompetent mothers, as drudges, or as being sexually promiscuous. And that was through the trope of adoption. So then these stories feature Indian mothers who adopt their children, sometimes intertribally and sometimes interracially. So Pauline Johnson's story is about an Indian mother who adopts a white child. And so then you have access to the language of maternity without the sort of danger or call of containment against women's sexuality. Okay, so that's a great solution in one way, but then its limitations are that Indian women's agency and Indian women's sexuality has to be repressed. So we have to look at that too, as that was a cost of having access to the language of and the ideas of maternalism that were so dominant in the social reform era of that time and in the literary works.
Mm. You actually, in that second chapter, you start or early in the second chapter, at least, you quote at length from this report by Reverend J.J. Garrett, which I think really yeah. illustrates that. I mean, so the report, basically, I mean, J.J. Garrett is this person who's dispatched by the very misnamed Indian Rights Association, which I encourage people to go back a few interviews. We had an author who talking about them. But he's there essentially to abduct her child, what he would view as this benevolent educational gesture. And in resisting this, I mean, there are different ways in which in this little vignette you see this family trying to resist this abduction. I mean, the mother goes as far to draw her own blood. But Garrett is completely undeterred. And you write that this episode suggests how difficult it was for Indian families to harness this force of sentiment and shift the imperatives of child removal policies. You even actually go so far in the opening of this chapter to say that sentiment drove Indian policy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think it plugs back into this idea of domesticity and that it was working at different registers, and sentiment and domesticity are very deeply intertwined. And, Laura Wexler has done incredible work around this idea that when you have these nurturing ideas of education and national domestication, in which there's a hearth and a home and peace and this perfect alignment between the personal property and the personal home and belonging to the state, that all of those ideas occlude and push away the possible violences that are necessary for those things to exist. And so under the language of sentimental ideas of home and hearth and nurturing and uplift, these very violent policies could be enacted. By making the white middle-class home sort of the apex of civilization and then refusing to accept and violently eradicating all other forms of kinship and homemaking and child rearing and just emotional affiliation. Those are very violent ruptures that are made possible by the language of sentimentality and by the language of domesticity and domestication. And so the Indian Rights Association, they were humanitarian in the sense that given the previous, you know, call for Indian extinction, they considered themselves humanitarian because they said, well, we only want to change Indians. We don't want to kill them. But in fact, their policies did try to kill the Indian culturally right. and spiritually in terms of their Indian selves. And that's what so many cultural actors, artists, leaders, writers, you know, were fighting to articulate that Indian self that was under assault. And you see it very dramatically in these works by these writers of this time. Hmm.
So I think probably the best known author that you discuss is Darcy McNichol. And The Surrounded is a book that often finds its way on literature lists at colleges, even not necessarily in Native American studies, though most often in Native literary classes. What did you want to bring to this discussion of Darcy McNichol? And what do you mean by disciplinary paternalism?
Oh, yes. Okay, so again, I think that within this larger rubric of domestication and domesticity, that the guardian wardship structure of Indian and federal affairs was that the language of benevolent paternalism has been taken for granted, even when people put it in quotation marks, like benevolent paternalism. I felt that we actually needed a different term to think about what was going on. And because in the writings of the Indian Rights Association activists themselves, you know, they understood and they articulated a plan that would hurt Indians. They knew that their policies would be painful, and that they knew their policies were violent, but they believed that it was for the Indians' own good. And that's a sense of sort of parental disciplinary approach that, like, well, this is going to hurt, but it's going to be for your own good. That was acceptable. I was looking for a term that would be acceptable to the actors themselves. And because I think that benevolent paternalism just lets too many things slide through its fingers. You know, it's too loose of a term.
Right.
I think to be more specific, they knew what they were doing, and it was disciplinary, and these policies are disciplinary, and we still have the structure of disciplinary paternalism when we look at unincorporated territories. And, you know, still even in Native contexts, we have that to this day. That's the structure of our relationship to the federal government. It's disciplinary. It's not benevolent. And I just wanted a sharper term for naming that.
Sure.
And in talking about the Surrounded, which features the cornerstone relationship is between Arshil, the son, and his father. That's a really important relationship. But what I bring to you this reading of this wonderful masterpiece of a novel is I talk about the women characters, Elise, particularly Elise, which is the girlfriend, and Catherine, the mother, and the ways in which their trajectories and their storylines give a critique of the type of agency that is available under the our liberal rights system. And I think that's one piece that I think has been under-examined. There's a great deal of analysis of this, you know, amazing book. And I felt like their part in the book really needs some close analysis and understanding how agency and autonomy and action were sort of working at different registers throughout the book. And I think thinking of them is very useful for understanding the book.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the legacy of these writers? I know that's kind of a broad question, but, you know, what do you see as the sort of long-term impact of people like Darcy McNichol or Pauline Johnson or any of the folks you raise here?
Yeah. Well, one thing is, you know, their stories are, you know, they were gifted writers as a group. And, you know, their work hold up to time because because they were good at their craft. So that's one thing. Like, they just produced good literature. I think what, you know, as a literary history project, what I would like to emphasize about what I think is lasting about their work is their politics in their contexts and how brave they were and how visionary in terms of being able to engage the politics of their day and so with such nuance and force be able to turn these plots around, to imagine other plots, to be able to bend the genres the way they were able to do, to make a space for Native voices and Native political identities that were not conceptualized anywhere else. They were unthinkable under the law. They were unthinkable in the mainstream literary genres. They had to create a new space for, you know, Native histories and experiences to live in. And I think that's really a lasting legacy. And I don't, you know, I think that, you know, I do think that historical specificity is very important to me. And so I want to understand, you know, that there's a relationship between early writers and later writers. But I think the relationship is that they all spoke to the politics of their time, and they all did it in ways that made the most sense for where they were. And so some things, I mean, I was frustrated because I think that some schools of thought don't recognize the politics of the writers of this time. And I think we need to make those politics very clear and very legible, because they're different politics than we have now. And it's partly because the material conditions and the legal conditions were different. So what was thinkable or possible during that time is different than what's thinkable or possible now. And I think we really need to be in awe and to honor these writers for what they were able to do in their times. And also, you know, just back to the state fact that you know, works like McNichols, you know, that would hold up in any era, you know. It's just brilliant writing.
Mm-hmm. So, despite how historically specific in a lot of ways these works are, you do, at least in the conclusion, mm-hmm. hint at least some of the themes that we can still see play out today. I mean, mm-hmm. you talk particularly about immigration reform, and that's in the news a lot right now. Particularly, you draw out this idea of biometric testing, this mm-hmm. monitoring system. What do you think we can learn from the period you discuss in this book that might help us complicate mm-hmm. Some of the terms of engagement on issues like immigration or even marriage?
Yeah, well, this is very much a book about citizenship, and that's one of the things that's really interesting about this assimilation period for Native people is that it is tracking and producing the shift from domestic subject, which was the legal designation of Native people, to citizen. And so we can see how these ideas of what a U.S. citizen is gets worked out on the bodies and on the imaginaries of Native people. And that has relevance to everyone today. It has relevance for all state subjects. And also, you know, just I think that the history of Indian citizenship is often thought of as being irrelevant or somehow outside of the dominant narrative of immigration and integration into U.S. society. But the thing about looking at the Native experience during this time is that there were very specific taxonomies and very specific modes of behavior and labor and racial composition that were expected of of American citizens, and that they are very clearly articulated during this period in ways that they are not so clearly articulated today. So just to draw a line between, you know, some of the things that I discuss in Chapter 3 around a performative taxonomy of citizenship, you know, there were these competency commissions that would go out and visit Indian homes and decide whether the people there were fit to be citizens. And they had this set of measurements where they would say, how much Indian blood do they have? So there's a biometric measure. Do they speak English? Have they been to school? Are they sober? Are they married? How many children do they have? They would measure the barns. They would measure the barns, right? Like, how many square feet is their barn? They would talk about their crops. They would say how many harnesses they had. Inside of the house, they would count, is there a telephone? Is there a piano? All of these things would add up to this person is fit or not to be a citizen. Is this woman a good housekeeper? These are all parts of the way that citizenship, U.S. citizenship, was defined. What we have today in the language of the DREAM Act is that if someone is of good moral character, and that, I think, is how do we know what that is? Somehow it's known, and it's known through these racialized histories of citizenship and thinking not only about Native American experience, but also Asian exclusion and different moments of where these definitions and these sort of taken for granted ideas about what a citizen is get worked out in very explicit and embodied ways. So that's what I think the relevance is today.
I'm reminded of I have friends who are undocumented activists, and they are often incredibly uncomfortable, if not outraged, at the way parents, you have a discourse in politics, and liberals do this very much so too, where the DREAM Act is framed in a way where while the children are deserving subjects, it's their parents that committed the crime. You know,
right.
There's no, you know, these children, it's no fault. Their parents,
no fault,
you know,
of their own.
No fault,
exactly,
of their own. Implicit in that is that the parents have done something really heinous and reprehensible.
Right. Right, and that language, so, you know, again, I would say this is something, one of the questions that Margaret Jacobs, who is an amazing historian, her work really impacted me on this discussion about the removal of Indian children, is that the assumption was that all Indian parents were incompetent. Where child removal would happen selectively among other populations, say poor working class women in the cities, then the welfare agencies would come in and remove their children. Mm-hmm. That was a case-by-case basis. But in the case of Indian child removal, the assumption was all Indian parents. And you have the exact same idea about these young immigrants who came to the United States, quote, through no fault of their own, right? They were innocent. Their parents were not only criminals against the state, but against their own children.
Right, right.
And that exact discourse, it's the same. We should be thinking about the relationship between these things.
I was also, I thought that what you drew out very briefly was incredibly stark about the relationship between the language of blood quantum in determining Indian status in this period that your book is about, and this biometric testing, this idea that you can kind of pinpoint or mark blood in a way that allows you to cross borders or not cross borders. That language and metaphor of blood seems to be one that's resilient in American culture and politics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's still there. So I've been speaking with Beth Piatot. She's the author of Domestic Subjects, Gender, Citizenship, and Law in Native American Literature. It's just released from Yale University Press. And as I said at the outset, it's the first book published in the newly inaugurated, now inaugurated, Henry Rowe Cloud series on American Indians and modernity. I know that this wonderful project just came to fruition, and I always feel a little bit bad after what must have been a very exhausting process to ask, what are you doing next? But I nevertheless find that I like to ask it. So now that you're done with this one, what are you thinking about next? And when can we have you back on the program?
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. And I have two projects I'm working on right now. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that I am Nez Perce, and I've been working in the Nez Perce language for about 10 years. And right now I'm involved in a collaboration with the linguistics department here at UC Berkeley to create an audio dictionary of the Nez Perce language. So that's a big project I'm working on. I'm also working on some translations from Nez Perce into English. So that's, I sort of have a translation project. And then my next sort of law culture project is I want to do a project on I can't get away from The Surrounded because I love it so much. Mm-hmm. So I want to do I want to look at sound and sovereignty in The Surrounded and in a couple other novels and the ways there are political articulations through sound, through drumming and singing, and through sort of atemporal responses and things like this. Particularly because sound has this ability to create different borders than the geopolitical borders that are operating in a book like The Surrounded. So those are some things that I'm kind of tinkering around with right now.
That is fascinating and exciting. So looking forward to that. Beth Biotode, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Andrew.
That was Beth H. Biotode, author of Domestic Subjects, Gender, Citizenship, and Law in Native American Literature, and this is New Books in Native American Studies. You can find us on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past interviews free of charge, or on iTunes, where you can subscribe and download to the podcast. We're also on Facebook, where you can leave comments, questions, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks for listening.